Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my taste.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Two Jewish is Greg Schneider, Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference on the new survey of Holocaust knowledge in the U.S. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Two Jewish maven on Israel, Amir Eden, and our Shinshinim Chen Denachi and Tom Eder Shakuri. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. The mess in Gaza next to the Israeli border continues to worsen, and the PR for Israel has all been terrible. Palestinians claim over 100 people have been killed trying to storm the border fence, more than 50 in one day last week, and then well over 1,000 have been wounded in clashes with Israeli troops. The loss of life and the injuries sustained are tragic. But it is important to understand just what is going on and who's creating this situation and why. The first important fact is that Israel unilaterally withdrew from Gaza way back in 2005 and does not physically occupy it at all. Hamas, an Islamist terrorist group, has controlled Gaza since it defeated Fatah in a brutal and ultra-violent civil war back in 2007 that killed about 700 Palestinians. Since that time, about 11 years, Hamas has used its authority and much of the foreign aid it receives for a variety of determined efforts to attack Israel and murder Israelis. The techniques have varied from sending rockets into schools and homes, to digging tunnels to try to kidnap and murder Israelis, to now sending kites with incendiary devices attached to burn Israeli fields. And of course, the Palestinians have tried, mostly unsuccessfully, to send suicide bombers into Israel itself in attempts to blow up malls, cafes, and buses. Israel has responded a variety of ways too, including three separate Israeli military operations against Hamas in Gaza, wars that were in response to Hamas's continued attacks over and under the border. In each of these wars, 2008, 12, and 14, Hamas was battered militarily and much of the infrastructure of Gaza was damaged or destroyed. The Israeli goal in these conflicts was well summarized by an independent RAND Corporation analysis. Dealing with Hamas in Gaza puts Israel in a strategic quandary. It needs to exert enough force to deter Hamas from attacking, but not so much that it topples the regime, lest an even more radical Islamist terror organization such as Al-Qaeda or ISIS take control. After each of these wars, Israel was harshly criticized for the disproportionate nature of the casualties, since so many more Palestinians were killed than Israelis. Of course, that's the goal for any nation in a war. And after each of these wars, Gaza was at least partially rebuilt, although many countries and NGOs, including Arab moderate nations, refused to work with Hamas. That brings us to this spring, when Hamas organized a series of huge bum rushes at the border fence with Israel, time to embarrass Israel for its 70th anniversary celebrations, and then to gain maximum press coverage during the Western calendar celebration of Israel's milestone birthday that coincided with the opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem last week. This tactic was designed by Hamas to create Palestinian casualties that could be trumpeted as martyrs, to emphasize the Palestinian interpretation of the original founding of Israel as the Nakba, the great catastrophe for Palestinians. That being said, the IDF, the Israeli military, has responded with as much restraint as it could, but its usual tactics at suppressing riots have proved to be less than effective in the face of these mass demonstrations. While no nation in the world would tolerate a deliberate invasion of a closed border by a hostile enemy, the usual Israeli anti-riot measures, tear gas, rubber bullets, and the like, have been countered by Palestinians wearing gas masks, burying Israeli tear gas canisters immediately or tossing them back over the fence, and throwing rocks over the border fence. This has proven to be at least as damaging as the rubber bullets Israeli soldiers are trying to shoot through a fence. In addition, some Hamas fighters, armed with firearms, have been inserted among the rioters, and they open fire from point-blank range. As a result of the large-scale nature of these attacks and the danger the Palestinian mobs pose to Israeli soldiers and the nearby Israeli communities should these mobs successfully enter Israel, Israeli soldiers have used live ammunition, resulting in deaths and many injuries among the Palestinians. Even if bullets are aimed at the legs of attackers, some will ricochet and kill people. All of which has led to public condemnation and diplomatic fights with Turkey, among other nearby nations. Mind you, when Turkey was busy brutally repressing its own citizens and its press after the failed coup a year or two ago, Israel and most of the West was quite muted in its criticism. Ben-Dror Yamini, a columnist for the popular centrist Israeli newspaper Yedioth Ahronot, wrote this last week about what he called the Nakba culture, which has held back Palestinians all the way, well, since 1948. There was a Nakba, he wrote in Yedioth last week, using that Arabic term for the catastrophe of the formation of Israel, the loss of Palestinians' homes. The Arabs of Palestine underwent expulsion. However, tens of millions of people throughout the whole world, including Jews, underwent similar expulsion. But only the Palestinians adopted an ethos of rejectionism, victimhood, suffering, and death. Aaron Lerman, a former deputy national security advisor who now runs a conservative think tank in Jerusalem, said Israelis don't believe that their army was callous about the loss of life. The only possible conclusion is they were left with very little choice, he said. He believes casualty numbers were actually quite low compared to with a nightmare scenario. A few hundred Palestinians dashing in the direction of a kibbutz or a military position in hopes of grabbing soldiers and civilians, killing some and dragging others into Gaza. Israel continues to receive terrible press about Gaza, including here in the United States, and it's clear there is a great need for improved methods in responding to this kind of attack. But to assume that there is an easy way to coexist with Hamas after 11 years of unceasing attacks is naive and dangerous. In better news, today is Shavuot, Chag Sameach, the least appreciated and celebrated of the three major pilgrimage festivals. In fact, the major Jewish holiday that definitely has the least positive PR of all. Conceptually, that's a very difficult thing to understand. Shavuos remembers one of the most, if not the most important event our people ever experienced. Shavuot is also the Feast of Weeks, called Pentecost in Latin, because it completes 50 days from Passover, the Festival of Freedom, to Shavuot on the 50th day after the beginning of Pesach. And Shavuot, of course, is the holiday of Revelation. In practical terms, though, it has never had the buzz of Passover or even Sukkot. That's partly because Shavuot may be the Feast of Weeks, but unlike its pilgrimage festival cousins, it only lasts one day, or two if you are conservative or orthodox and live outside of Israel. Blink and you'll miss it, which isn't true for other Jewish festivals. And while Passover celebrates freedom from slavery and Sukkot is the holiday of harvest, Shavuot celebrates revelation at Mount Sinai, receiving the Ten Commandments. That's more specific and less universal than the themes of the other pilgrimage holidays. It's a powerful and extremely important festival. Without Shavuot, you don't really have Judaism. But it's harder in contemporary terms to wrap your mind around. All of which shouldn't mean we don't celebrate Shavuot, this wonderful festival that recalls our closest connection to God ever. And so, to play us in this morning, here's a medley of Sephardi Mizrahi songs for Shavuot, Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe, or Asha Kehilat Yaakov. The Torah was given us through Moses, an inheritance of the congregation of Jacob.
Moshe, Mora Shakila, Yaakov, Oi Torah, Torah.
That was Torah Tziva Lanu Moshe. The Torah was given us through Moses in honor of Shavuot today. Our guest this morning, Greg Schneider, is the executive vice president of a highly important and poorly understood organization, the Claims Conference, which has long done crucial work assisting Holocaust survivors and has just released a new study on awareness of the Holocaust in America. Find out its surprising discoveries when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun, a place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol, the best games in town, amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Greg Schneider is the executive director of the Claims Conference, a very important but I think not terribly well understood organization that has just released a new survey demonstrating that Americans don't know very much about the Holocaust. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Can you first introduce the Claims Conference, which I've spoken about occasionally here on the radio show over the years, but I think many Jews and others don't understand exactly what the Claims Conference is?
Sure. The Claims Conference, the full name is the Conference on Jewish Material Claims Against Germany. And the name, although a mouthful, which is why people refer to it as the Claims Conference, was set up in 1951. Established by 23 national and international Jewish organizations to be a unified voice in making claims, material claims, that means money, not moral, not apologies, not reconciliation, but financial claims against Germany on behalf of survivors, Holocaust survivors, and those who were killed. So all of the compensation that survivors have received, people who receive pensions, one-time payments, and now today a range of welfare services, including home care, all of that is negotiated by the Claims Conference.
It has been a very important source of support for many, many survivors and their families over the years. And as this last group of the survivor generation passes on, tell me a little bit about how the Claims Conference has evolved.
So the original negotiations in 1951 really focused on pensions and one-time payments. So people who were in camps, concentration camps, extermination camps, and ghettos, and were in hiding, like Anne Frank, until she was discovered, generally receive pensions, monthly payments. And people who fled from the Nazis receive one-time payments. So over the decades, there have been hundreds of thousands of people who received pensions and one-time payments. But about 10, maybe 15 years ago, we were really focused on the fact that even with the payments, there were survivors who needed more, who needed help. They needed home care, and in some cases, very, very poor survivors who need help with food, with medicine. And so we began a program of welfare services, whether the person was receiving a pension or not, or a one-time payment. And so over the years, we've really much more focused on bringing welfare services to survivors. And today, that's over $500 million a year. Now, this is worldwide, not only in the United States, but still, it has a tremendous effect on about 150,000 survivors.
We will return in just a moment with Greg Schneider of the Claims Conference on Too Jewish and talk about this new survey that's just been released, exploring the critical gaps in the awareness of basic facts and understanding of the Holocaust. That's pretty widespread. We'll hear all about that when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast, Top 10 in America, according to Moment magazine. We welcome our maven on Israel, Amir Eden, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We started talking last week about Israeli Arabs who are Arab Israelis, right?
Right.
They live, they're full citizens.
Were
they
born
vote,
there, raised there.
Born there,
can
raised
go
there.
Anywhere they want.
They have their own political parties. They
Absolutely.
Vote in elections. They vote
Absolutely.
For prime minister. And they vote against the prime minister. They do all that thing. Serve in the military. Well, let's talk about that. They serve in the police forces. Let's talk about
Correct.
The military. There are some distinctions that are made in Israel.
Correct. So basically, obviously, you have the IDF, the Israel Defense Forces. You know, the majority there are Jewish. You have Christians. You have Muslims. I won't say that it's a majority. No. I won't say it's a very large group. No. We have the Druzin and we have the Bedouins, of course, that, you know, for many years, they're devoted to Israel.
Loyal. So some of them extremely talented. Their particular specialties that are
Correct,
known.
Correct.
They've been Druze major generals and so on.
Right. Again, it's not black and white. You know, Seiret
right.
Matkal, which is one of the best top units in Israel,
right.
you know, it had a Druze in it. You know, so it's not that that it's only for Jews. Of course not.
Now, having said that, most Muslim Arab citizens of Israel do not serve in the IDF.
Correct. So it's a combination probably of two. One is that they don't want to,
right?
You know, and obviously they can do national service. You know, they can serve.
Now, do they do national service?
Not all, some.
Not a large percentage, but some. Right.
Some. Yeah. And then obviously there's always the security clearance that you have to go through. You know, so it's not. It would be hard to say someone who's not devoted to the country, here's the weapon or an F-16. You know,
right.
So it's there's complicity, of course.
So other distinctions. While the public schools are both Arab and Israeli, Arab and Jewish.
So yes and no. Sometimes
where,
it depends right. where in Israel, of course.
I mean, but the religious schools, of course, different story.
Correct.
But the non-religious schools, which is what most Israelis go to, the Chiloni schools.
Correct.
Tell me a little bit about how that
So
works.
You have cities that you have only Jews there, you know,
right.
living there only Jews. So therefore, it would be only Jews there. You have some that are combined and it will be combined. You know, if you look at Haifa.
Haifa is famous for
Haifa
this,
is
right?
famous for having yeah. a school that has everyone in. Yeah.
Right. And also, it's famous for, by and large, good relationships
Absolutely.
Between Arabs and Israelis.
And also, Akko.
Akko.
Akko,
too, right in the north.
Jaffa, yeah.
Maybe it's just the coast.
Could be.
The other distinctions that you hear, and by the way, there are some also very affluent Israeli Arabs and very successful in business. But
right.
Is there such a thing as a second-class citizenship relationship in some ways? Because certainly people have made that case.
Right. So I don't see that, you know, when I look at sports, you know, I'm really into sports and I
right.
played soccer and coached soccer.
You have soccer ties.
Yes.
You have all kinds of,
right.
you're
so
a big
I really
football
love,
guy.
Really love soccer. And if you look at the national team.
You the Qatar Regal. You know,
yeah, so
that.
Both. You have Israelis who are Jews, Israelis who are Arabs on the national team for many, many years. You know, as a matter of fact, if you look at the current national team, the captain, okay, is not Jewish. And that's okay. So I don't know, saying second-class citizens, you know, I think people probably think about when they see all the, you know, roadblocks or, the, you know.
Sure.
And that's a different story. That's people who are coming from.
From the West Bank,
you know,
usually,
from Judea and Samaria.
Judea and Samaria. Well,
yes,
we'll call it. Well,
it depends, well, you know.
Depends.
Who
yeah,
calls and what, yeah.
You know, it's such an interesting country where even the name you use for a piece of land
true,
can
true.
Set you as a member of a particular political party.
Correct.
Amir, thanks so much.
Correct.
We will talk next week.
Thank you for having me.
We welcome our, what do you say, Shinshina?
Shinshinit.
Shinshinit. Our Shinshinit, Chen Denachi, representing Israel here in America. Boker Tov, good morning.
Boker Tov.
So we're getting to the end of the school year here in southern Arizona, really to the, all over America, which means it's getting to the end of your most intense period of service. What observations do you have? You know, what thoughts looking back and looking forward?
Well, I can't believe that it's almost over. It feels like I've been here. On one hand, it feels like I've been here for like 4 years. On the other hand, it feels like I've only been here for 5 minutes. I really don't know how to go back, even though I miss my family and my friends. It's like I built a life
dog.
Here.
Don't forget your dog.
My puppy,
yeah,
Mitzi.
Oh,
the baby. The 12-year-old puppy. I think I really don't know how to say goodbye to all the kids I've met here. Like, I really feel like a lot of the kids I see in so many different aspect of their lives. Like, they would, like, come to the J for, like, J care, and I'd be like, hi, and then I'd see them, like, at religious school, like, hi again. Then I'll see them at, like, synagogue for services, or I don't know, like, at this event, and be like, it's me again. And I basically, like, see them everywhere, which is gonna be so weird to not have. And I feel like the families, and like, it's just very weird for me to start processing the fact that it's all gonna be over. But I'm also very, very grateful. I feel like I've got a lot. I learned a lot about teaching, and I've learned a lot about education in America. I really feel like I've learned a lot about different cultures.
What do you think you're going to take back with you to Israel that's your favorite thing about the experience of being in America? What are you going to bring back and feel like it's something you really gained?
Well, you know how they ask you, like, tell me one thing about yourself, and suddenly you don't remember anything?
Yeah.
It's exactly like, it's exactly the thing, because I'm going to take so many little things. But I think one really big thing is how large and rich the, like, rich in culture, the Jewish American culture is. Like, I had no idea. I never realized that American Jews had their own songs and had their own traditions. And it just, like, I never even comprehended fully that I'm Jewish until I got here, because Jewish was always the default, you know, in Israel.
Right. Everybody's Jewish. Kulanu Yehudim, right? Everybody's,
yeah,
Jewish. So.
So I feel like the one thing I'm going to take back is that there's a Jewish world out there, not just in Israel, which I knew but never really processed fully.
It's, you know, one of the wonderful things about the way, about having, you know, a 70-year-old Israel, a strong, successful country, that it allows diaspora communities, and the United States is the largest and most important diaspora community today, and has been now for a long time, to have their own culture and weight, and yet still love Israel, and,
yeah,
understand and begin to understand Israel through your work and others. Maybe it's time for Israel to also understand diaspora culture.
Yeah, I really agree. That's something I think I'm going to do when I go back. I'm going to spread it around even to my friends and to more broad circles, to really, like, appreciate and strengthen that bond from our side too. And I think that's something I will definitely 100% will take with me. And that's the one thing I can tell you about myself.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We will talk next week. The Boy Scouts of America have gone through many changes over the last 5 years, and you may not know about them. The Boy Scouts now include boys who are members of the LGBT community and leaders from the LGBT community. Just last year, a pilot program for boys 5 years old and in kindergarten was added, and a family program for girls 5 through 9 years old who can now join Cub Scouts. A key Boy Scout law says a scout is reverent, and duty to God is now a component for scout rank. Interfaith prayer is used whenever members of multiple faiths are present. In the early 70s, some Jewish organizations dropped sponsorship of scouting because of the lack of inclusion, but it's time for the Jewish community to return to its support for this great organization. Judaism shares principles that are represented and taught by the Boy Scouts of America. Scouting's a great place to inculcate good values and a shared philosophy, to develop better adjusted and contributing young people who will become future leaders. Scouting is more than camping. It's a variety of activities promoting physical and mental health and emotional growth. Scouting schedules activities so as not to interfere with religious and other family activities, and to include other members of the nuclear family. Scouting's an enhancement of religious, communal, and familial life. And that's true from the youngest level of scouting. Currently, only one unit chartered by a Jewish organization, PAC 613 in Tucson, exists in the state of Arizona. If you are in the Tucson area, contact Herb at Shofarman, Shofarman, at AOL.com, or call the Catalina Council at 520-750-0385. That's 750-0385. New members are very welcome in the scouting family. Scouting's there for all members, in good times and bad, helping in every way. Contact the Scouting Council in your area. Go to www.beascout.org. or www.my.scouting.org. Ask your local council if they have a Jewish committee on scouting who can come to your synagogue or organization and see if scouting is just the thing to further your mission to the community. You can also contact the National Jewish Committee on Scouting, www.jewishscouting.org. Scouting is great for you and your family. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been exploring the Jewish heritage of Spain over the last few weeks following your recent trip there. You know, there's a current experience of Spain. I love going to Spain. The food's wonderful. You have to be a little careful, though, don't you?
Well, again, and I keep insisting on this point, perhaps pedantically, but I was only in Andalusia, which is very different from northern Spain or the Basque country or Catalonia. I mean, and regional cuisine in Spain is a very real thing. It's at least as real as it is in Italy or in the U.S. I mean, our food is much more homogeneous than theirs. So I'm only going to talk about Andalusian food and wine.
Absolutely.
But it is true that in general in Spain, and a lot of people, friends, reacted to my Facebook post saying, like, how'd you find anything to eat there? And these were obviously Jewish friends, because even some of my least observant Jewish friends have an aversion to eating pig products and or shellfish. They may go out and eat a hamburger. They might even eat a cheeseburger. But they still have an aversion to a whole meal
bacon,
based
pork,
on ham and shrimps. So in Spain, it is very hard to avoid pig products. Less so in Andalusia than in other parts of Spain, but it's still hard. And shellfish are ubiquitous. That being said, a lot of the restaurants I went to prided themselves on really local cuisine, and some even underline the Sephardic roots of their cuisine. And they would say, typical Sephardi dish about something. One of the few exceptions I encountered that probably was a Sephardic dish, but was described as a Cordovan specialty, was this delicious kind of hot mess of spinach, chickpeas, lemon, garlic, and olive oil.
Sounds
all
very
like
Sephardic
sauteed
to me.
Together.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I mean, it's hard to believe that that may not have been invented by the Sephardim, but I'm sure they ate it. It was delicious. And it was a good example of something that was purely vegetarian. So, you know, only people who are really careful about what something is cooked in could have an objection to that, because the pot or pan might have once been used for something else. But there was nothing intrinsically unkosher about that dish. And there were a lot of other dishes featuring bacalao, which is dried cod, which was the basis of a lot of the motivation for many of the great journeys of exploration, discovering the Americas.
Was cod, and the Basques were preeminent in that.
So there were a lot of great dried cod dishes, a lot of simple grilled tuna and stuff like that, and a lot of eggplant dishes. And my favorite one of many was eggplant cut into spears and dredged in flour, and it looked like French fries, slightly longer and skinnier than French fries. And it was topped with two things. One was like a simple syrup, like a syrup almost honey. And the other was this pounded mixture of hot red chilies and cream cheese. Hmm. So it was sort of red little dollops of cheese that were slightly spicy and slightly cheesy. That was fabulous. I mean, I could have made a whole dinner from that. Plus, the local wines are great, and they're suitable to the climate, which is very hot and sunny, so the whites are really light and refreshing and low alcohol, like 9% alcohol. The reds are a little heavier, but still relatively light. And I would say that this is one of the few regions of Spain where it is relatively easy for a slightly observant Jew to eat well and not worry about being constantly buffeted by a wave of ham, bacon, shellfish, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, I'm getting hungry just hearing about all this, Tom. Thanks. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Chaim asks his wife Naomi what she wants for their 30th wedding anniversary. Would you like a new diamond bracelet, he asks. Not really, says Naomi. How about a new Lexus, says Chaim. No, she replies. What about a vacation home in Hawaii, he says. She again rejects his offer. No thanks. Well, Chaim asks, what do you want for our anniversary? I'd like a divorce, Chaim answers Naomi. Oy, says Chaim, I wasn't planning to spend that much. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we chant the second portion of the book of Numbers, Naso, which includes a remarkable blessing. The Birkat Kohanim, the priestly blessing, is really three distinct brachot, three separate prayers, with which the ancient priests are commanded to bless the people of Israel. From its inception, this three-part blessing had exceptional importance. As the Torah quotes God saying, with this blessing you will place my name on the people of Israel, Samu et Shemi al Bnei Yisrael. That is, this very blessing conveys God's presence among us and offers God's protection. The blessing was given by the Kohanim, the highest class of priests, those entrusted with the service of the tabernacle and temple. We still use this blessing at every joyous life cycle event, and it remains powerful. The text is, may God bless you and guard you. May the light of God's presence shine on you and be gracious to you. May God's presence turn to you and grant you peace. In essence, the Birkat Kohanim asks God to supply our most important needs. Most interpretations of it see the first blessing requesting physical safety and health, the second asking for our material needs to be satisfied, and the third blessing seeking spiritual comfort and confidence. Without any of these blessings, our lives become a challenge. With all three, we are assured of true quality of life. After thousands of years, those three elements, safety, grace, and peace, remain central to our lives and a gift from God. May you be blessed with each of these, with all of these, this week and always. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Greg Schneider, Executive Vice President of the Claims Conference, will explain just what Americans know about the Holocaust, why that concerns all of us. Find out when we come back in a moment here on To Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
While most of the world focused on who attended the opening of the American embassy in Jerusalem, which other embassies have moved to Jerusalem already, just Guatemala and Panama so far, and the bad news and ugly photos from Gaza, other places around the world celebrate Israel's 70th birthday on the secular calendar with some amazing displays. Most extraordinarily, the Christ Redeemer statue in Rio de Janeiro, managed by the Catholic Church, glowed white and blue last Monday night for Israel. Commenting on the Rio tribute, Israel's honorary consul there, Osias Werman, said, "It is a historic event in the Jewish-Christian relationship in Brazil. For the first time in 70 years, the most important symbol of the Christian faith in Brazil was illuminated with Israel's blue and white." The illumination event of the 100-foot-tall Jesus landmark in Rio, located on a 700-foot-high mountain peak, was attended by Israeli Ambassador Yossi Shelley and the president of the Rio Jewish Federation, Harry Rosenberg. A symbol of Christianity across the world since its dedication in 1931, the Rio statue is one of the new seven wonders of the world. Brazil is home to 130,000 Jews. Israel is home to 150,000 Christians. This homage today conveys a message of peace and respect. There is always room for all religions, said Shelley, who was recently awarded an honorary citizen medal by the Rio Municipal Chamber. April 22nd, 2,000 Jews celebrated Yom HaAtzmaut at a Jewish club in Rio de Janeiro, including Rio's mayor, Marcelo Crivella, who donated an area to build the city's first Holocaust memorial. The mayor laid the cornerstone for the site in 2017. Earlier last month, the words Holocaust Never Again in Portuguese were projected on Brasil's National Congress buildings in Brasilia, an unprecedented honor to mark International Holocaust Remembrance Day in the country's capital city. And, improbably in Poland, the Warsaw Bridge and that city's iconic Palace of Culture and Science were also lit in blue and white for Israel last Monday. Kind of amazing.
Ouch. ouch. Ha! La bere ouch, 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 la bere. Look at me, I'm a beautiful creature. I don't care about your modern time preacher. Welcome, boys, too much noise, I will teach ya. Pum, pum, pow, pum, pum, pow. Hey, I think you forgot how to play. My teddy bear's running away. The Barbie got something to say. Hey, 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 hey. My summer says leave me alone. I'm taking my Pikachu home. You're stupid just like you're smart. Divine and he's about to regret. He's a buck up knock buck 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 buck.
Israel's Netta Barzilai won the Eurovision Song Contest in Lisbon last week, bringing Israel its fourth victory in the glitzy pageant, watched by over 200 million people around the world, and the right to host the event in Israel next year. Next time in Jerusalem, Barzilai, a smiling 25-year-old live looping artist, shouted after being named the winner, "I'm so happy. Thank you for accepting differences between us. Thank you for celebrating diversity." Wearing a Japanese-style kimono and a geisha hairdo, Barzilai won with a lively dance mix, singing "I'm Not Your Toy." It has a woman's empowerment twist, beating Cyprus's entry, Elena Ferreira, who finished second. "I believe authenticity passes through," said Netta Barzilai, who has previously described the message of her song as being about female power and justice, but with a happy, colorful vibe. Her instantly recognizable song began with Barzilai mimicking chicken clucking sounds to loud cheers from fans. Cyprus and Israel were the bookies' favorites going into the 63rd edition of Eurovision that was hosted in the Portuguese capital for the first time. Israel made its debut in Eurovision in 1971 and previously won in 78, 1979, and 1998. Lisbon hosted Eurovision this year after Portugal's Salvador Sobral won last year's contest in Ukraine. And next year, thanks to Netta Barzilai's victory, it will be in Israel. Mazel tov, or as Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu posted, mazel toy. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Greg Schneider, is Executive Director of the Claims Conference on Material Claims Against Germany, the Claims Conference for short, which has done so much to assist survivors over the, boy, now 67 years of its existence. You all funded a recent survey exploring what people know about the Holocaust in the United States. Can you explain the evolution of that study and the most important initial findings?
So the main work of the Claims Conference is paying pensions and one-time payments to survivors recognizing their persecution. The second main pillar of work is home care, food and medicine, welfare services for very poor survivors. But there's a third piece, which is about research, education, and documentation of the Shoah, of the Holocaust. And the basic idea is that we hear again and again and again from survivors, as much as they care about their pensions, and they certainly care about their health and being taken care of, you know, not having to decide between food and medicine, ultimately, they beg us, don't let the world forget what happened. And so there's an imperative, there's a moral imperative to remember those who were murdered, and for those who survived, to talk and to remember their families and their communities that were destroyed. And so over the years, the Claims Conference also spends money on Holocaust education. So this year we came to the notion that we really wanted to understand the level of knowledge about the Holocaust in American society, And by the way, we'll be doing this now in other countries as well. But we started with the U.S. To help us plan, to help us really create a roadmap of where we go from here in terms of Holocaust education. And honestly, the findings were a little bit shocking.
You know, considering the U.S. Holocaust Museum is one of the most visited sites in Washington, D.C., there are Holocaust memorials and monuments and museums all around the country. The most popular Jewish studies classes on campus seem to be Holocaust education classes. Some of these findings were really startling. One was that a third of all Americans and something like 40% of millennials, maybe more than 40%, believe that far fewer than 6 million Jews were killed in the Holocaust. Can you dig into that, those numbers a little bit?
Yeah, so let's look at, first of all, let's do the Oy Gevalt numbers, right? The numbers
right.
that indicate
right.
The real problem that exists. So as you said, looking at the number of Jews who were killed in the Holocaust. So obviously 6 million, we all know, everybody knows the number 6 million, I think in the Jewish community, or particularly people who are connected to a Jewish community, 6 million is an iconic, is like a known thing. So exactly as you said, 31% of Americans think that substantially fewer than 6 million, in fact, fewer than 2 million were killed. And if you look at millennials, which is defined in our study as 18 to 34-year-olds, it's 41%. So clearly, there's a tremendous lack of knowledge about what I think within the Jewish community we believe is basic. But it's really worse than that. We asked the question, do you know what Auschwitz is? So obviously, Auschwitz, the synonymous with evil, the most notorious, infamous extermination camp. 41% of Americans weren't able to say what Auschwitz was. They had no idea. But if you look at millennials, the number is 66%.
66% of millennials don't know what Auschwitz is.
Correct. That's correct. Americans, of American millennials.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
So that's shocking, right? That is shocking and tragic.
That is definitely an Oy Gevalt number, right? I think that's right.
Right. If you look at, we know, particularly one of the things the Claims Conference did was fund some research at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington about camps and ghettos. And there's an encyclopedia of camps and ghettos. And we know there were over 40,000 concentration camps, extermination camps, labor camps and ghettos, 40,000. So we asked Americans to name one. 45% of Americans cannot name one concentration camp or ghetto. So, there are a series of findings like this which indicate that there's a tremendous problem. There's just a tremendous lack of knowledge about the Holocaust.
I sometimes think that 49% of Americans couldn't name one-tenth of the presidents of the United States in their history, though. I mean, lack of knowledge is, for all of the tremendous information available to us on the web, I wouldn't say our systematic educational system here has really spectacular results. So is obviously it's a concern. What were the other significantly troubling issues that arose, and what were some of the more positive surprises in the survey?
So let me pick up on that point, because as I've been discussing the survey for the past for the past 2 weeks, since we released the results, people have said, well, let's understand the context, kind of like what you just said, that we have to understand that Americans' interest and knowledge in general about historical events is at an all-time low. And that could be because there's more of an interest in STEM,
science
and technology. People,
math, right.
Right. People are more interested these days in computer science or physics and, more educated people who have higher levels of education. The humanities is less interesting and certainly history. And does it really matter? Do you really need to know if 2 million Jews were killed or 6 million Jews were killed? What's the difference? So first of all, on that specific point, we pledge when we go to Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day events, and we pledge to survivors, never forget. We will never forget. We are literally forgetting. As a nation, we are literally forgetting. When you say 2 million people were killed as opposed to 6 million people, you have literally forgotten 4 million people. Now, over the arc of history, people won't remember all of the details. And as you say, particularly because every piece of information on the planet is available in everyone's cell phone in the palm of their hand, you could easily look up Auschwitz. Does it really matter? Do you really need to know? So I think we need to just spend a minute talking about how we got here. I think there was a whole generation of, first of all, survivors, who unfortunately, as we know, are passing away. But particularly for Americans, they're also American soldiers, brave American men at the time, who went to Europe, who fought against the Germans, and who helped liberate camps, who liberated many of the camps. And when they came back, they had stories. They had firsthand account. They understood what, you know, what happened, and they told their spouses, and they told their children. But when you get to second generation, and now third generation, grandchildren, even great-grandchildren, so you don't have them telling those stories in the same way, you know, 70 years later. And, you know, as the famous expression goes, those that don't remember history are condemned to repeat it. There's a very, very important lesson. Not only do the individual specific survivors, their family, I mean, murdered and their families deserve to be remembered, but there are lessons that emerge from the Holocaust about humanity and the darkest moment in humanity and how we confront totalitarianism. And those lessons are extremely important for our society. And so now is the pivotal time. We can't be the generation that lets this go. We can't be the weak link in the chain, because then the chain falls apart and there's nothing connecting us. So this brings me to now what I think is the positive side of the survey, which is also part of the reason we did it. Where do we go from here?
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the most upbeat, the most heartening result of the survey is that 93% of all people surveyed believe that all students should learn about the Holocaust in school. So what this tells us is that it's not that there's significant Holocaust denial, and there were other questions that went to that, and it comes across several places in the survey. In our society, we are not plagued by Holocaust denial in a very substantial way.
Not in the way the Arab countries are, or lots of Europe remains in some
way. Right, and not in a way that we have to place tremendous resources on combating that.
Right.
The biggest problem that we're facing is that people are just forgetting, mm-hmm. not from bad will, not because they're anti-Semitic, not because they deny the Holocaust, but because it recedes in memory and you know, it's not very important.
You know, I like to say, never put down to ill will what you can simply attribute to ignorance. People just don't know.
Just don't know. But in the survey, it comes across clear that people are not against learning about the Holocaust. Quite the contrary. 93%, I mean, when do you have a consensus of 93% on anything in American life today, right? We're such a polarized, unfortunately, we're such a polarized society.
Right.
But when you have 93% of the country saying that all students should learn about Holocaust, have Holocaust education in schools, that is a clear mandate. And so we must act on that. Now, the sad reality is that Holocaust education is mandated in 9 states. Not, out of the 50 states.
Wow, just 9. Not 49.
Right,
nine.
Which means there are 41 states in the Union where Holocaust education is not required. So it's a clear mandate. We must go to those states. We must go to, you know, boards of education and state legislatures and work through the system and create commissions that oversee Holocaust education in 41 additional states. And what we have to do is align what we're teaching in schools with what the American people say is important. It's not as if people are saying, well, this is not really important. The lessons aren't important. We don't really want to learn about it. We don't, you know, we shouldn't really focus. Don't spend time on this. It's the opposite. And this is why I say this is the hopeful result of the survey. 93% of Americans say it should be taught to all students. So we have to align what we believe with what we're actually doing, what we're teaching in the classroom. And my sort of final pitch is, teachers are our heroes. They're underpaid and overworked. Everybody understands that, even if we don't articulate it. So we have to give teachers the resources and the tools. Again, it's not ill will. It's not that the teachers don't want to teach Holocaust. And by the way, when I say it's not mandated in 41 states, it means it's not required. It doesn't mean it's not being taught. We
right.
did not look, mm-hmm. we did not do a survey of how many school districts are actually teaching it and how impactful and effectiveness. We didn't get there yet. I'm just saying it's not required. So first of all, we have to require it. But second of all, equally important is a little bit of funding to give teachers the tools, the education themselves. You know, teacher training is so important, Holocaust teacher training. One of the things we found in the survey, 80% of Americans have never been to any Holocaust museum or, you know, an educational institute. So I found that shocking because, as you said, the museum in Washington, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, is one of the most popular. It's an amazing
yeah, extraordinary
you know,
museum.
Educational experience right. to go there, through the museum.
And there's others that are excellent, the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles, the New Museum in Chicago, and there's museums and monuments really everywhere in the country now.
Everywhere in the country. The Museum of Jewish Heritage in Battery Park in New York City. There's one in Houston, right. as you mentioned, Chicago, L.A. I mean, it's not that it's hard to find, but I think it's coupled with this notion that it's not part of education. So when you have it as part of the curriculum, and then you take an afternoon and you take a student to see the museum, and hopefully even in the next few years, maybe meet a survivor, that's an impactful experience. And so we have to really build that in to our school systems across the country.
And, you know, one of the important findings in the survey, to me, a majority of Americans, 58%, believe something like the Holocaust could happen again. Which, of course, I think that's actually true. It could happen again. Part of our purpose really is to teach so that it does not happen again. That's
essential to who we are.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, it's mutually reinforcing because, in addition, one of the questions was, do you believe that it's important to teach about the Holocaust so it does not happen again? And 80% of people said yes. So again, 80% is very, very high. In this sort of survey, reinforcing the notion that there is a very strong consensus that it should be taught in schools and that it's important, and particularly has today, it's important for today. There are practical implications for today's and tomorrow's society. It's not that people feel generally, you know, it's important to learn about the Holocaust for the historical facts, but rather because it can help shape and improve our society today and the society, you know, that we live in.
I want to thank Greg Schneider for a great visit here on Too Jewish. If you want to find out more, you can go to claimscon.org, and the study is there, as well as a great deal more information about their work. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Really enjoyed it.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
There's magic in the air at this special place for fun. A place where fortune smiles and Tucson comes alive. This is Casino del Sol. The best games in town. Amazing dining and top-flight entertainment. This is a heart that beats with excitement, with passion and beauty. It's all waiting for you at Casino del Sol. This is the soul of Tucson. Presenting sponsor of University of Arizona Basketball, Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday on Too Jewish. Our guest will be David Hirschberg, author of the excellent new novel, My Mother's Son. And, of course, listen to all of our award-winning podcasts on iTunes or at our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning comes from the Eurovision winner, Netta Barzilai, a continuation of her winning toy song. My friends, may you have a good week. Chag Sameach, a happy holiday of Shavuot today, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I'm not your toy!
Sponsored by Too Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.